Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Houston Cantwell, Senior Resident Fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. Welcome back to Aerospace Nation. 80 years ago this month, the United States dropped the world's first atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Following World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union built massive nuclear arsenals. These weapons played a key role in nuclear deterrence through the strategy of mutually assured destruction. American nuclear weapons have also served as the foundation to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, extending a blanket of security to European allies. Today, we're witnessing a renewed global era of nuclear modernization and expansion. Both China and Russia are rebuilding their nuclear arsenals, while regional actors like North Korea and Iran remain a persistent risk. The United States Air Force stewards two legs of the nuclear triad, along with the Nuclear Command and Control Enterprise. Delayed recapitalization has put these foundational weapon systems at risk. That situation must be corrected. Given the importance of this topic, we're glad to welcome back Lieutenant General Andy Jabara. He's the Deputy Chief of Staff of the Air Force for the Strategic Deterrence and Nuclear Integration. General Jabara, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. Before we go to our questions, I'd like to offer you the opportunity for opening remarks.
Absolutely. Good morning, Houston. Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you as well for Mitchell for what you do. I absolutely think as we look at the international situation that we have today, that the topic of air power and air power issues absolutely needs to come to the national fore, and Mitchell does great work there. So thank you for having me on and the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, of course.
You know, one thing you said that I always take to heart, it is true that this is the 80th anniversary this summer of the end of World War II. We absolutely don't make light of the life lost at the end of the war, but I prefer to think of the lives saved as part of the ending of the war. I often hear questions like, well, can you imagine a world without nuclear weapons? Is that realistic in today's world? I actually find that easy to believe. We can see a world without nuclear weapons. That world is every day up until 1945. Yeah. It just so happened that was a horrific place of death, and we don't ever want to go back to that. And so I focus on the use of the weapons to keep that from ever happening again.
Right.
Now, I think you framed perfectly the international situation we're in, but it is also important to remember, and I think of this every day, this is not a repeat of the Soviet Union and the original Cold War. This is a new security environment we have not seen before. Multiple nuclear actors that don't just have minimal deterrence, but have the ability to be an existential threat to our nation. Additional regional nuclear actors, additional people that desire nuclear weapons. We have not seen a situation like this before, and it's going to require us to learn from history but not repeat history and go forward into the future. And so I think that's what your United States Air Force is doing, and I'm proud to be part of it.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of that, you talked about proliferation of nuclear weapons, other countries trying to pursue those. Let's move the conversation over to Operation Midnight Hammer.
Sure.
Where the United States Air Force was front and center and had a very successful operation, B-2s flying around the world and striking those nuclear facilities in the middle of Iran. What message does this operation send to our peer adversaries concerning our willingness to use force to enforce our red lines?
First of all, I couldn't be more proud of the airmen that executed Midnight Hammer.
Tremendous.
Both the B-2 crews, tanker crews, other assets within the Air Force. This was really a massive effort that took years to plan. I cannot promise that the Iranians won't try and get a nuclear weapon in the future, but I have high confidence that if they do, it won't be from those facilities. An amazing, amazing result. Now, what does this mean for our adversaries in the future? I really think when we consider deterrence, there's really three parts to it. You have to have capability, you have to have will, and you have to be seen as having both. And I think Midnight Hammer absolutely shows in spades that the United States has all three if our national interests are concerned.
Yeah, certainly did that. How about the message to our allies and partners?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I think it showed our allies and partners that we're serious, that we will enforce our interests and the interests of our partners, nations and allies. As you look at deterrence, the alter ego of deterrence is assurance, right? Making sure that those treaty partners and nations that rely on us for extended deterrence know that we will be there. Mm-hmm. If they lose faith in that over time, we are likely to see more nuclear powers, not less, which is not in our interest to do. And so we have extended deterrence agreements with a variety over 30 nations. And I think Midnight Hammer is a perfect example of showing our capability and will and showcasing that we have both.
Yeah, so important for our allies and partners to see
Absolutely.
That in action.
Absolutely.
I mean, we can make all of the statements that we want, all the proclamations that we want, but when you see the action, it really gives us a lot more credibility.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about our legacy force. So earlier this month, I got the chance to sit down with the commander of the 8th Air Force, and we chatted about our aging bomber fleet. As you're aware, our ICBM fleet are also quite old. Can you explain to us why is modernization so important to the credibility of nuclear deterrence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not young. But like me, they may be a little old, but they're still in the fight. Our deterrent force relies, again, first principles, capability, will, and be seen to have both. Over time, any equipment will age out, will need to be modernized, will need to be replaced. I think it's pretty well known the age of our B-52s, the age of our ICBMs. I will tell you, as a former B-2 pilot, when I joined the B-2, it had new car smell. The B-2s that we have today are as old as the B-52s were when I was a lieutenant and started flying B-52s. And I assure you, I did not think of the B-52 as a young plane when I was a lieutenant.
Right.
So it needs to be modernized. But beyond the ability of being able to keep up with the operational threat picture that we see today, beyond the logistics nature of what we see today, there also has to show our allies and partners and our adversaries that we have the will to continue. Let me just riff on this for just a second. About 2 weeks ago, I went down to Savannah River nuclear site. So this is a Department of Energy nuclear site that we are, the NNSA, the sub-organization of Department of Energy that builds our nuclear deterrent, is refurbing. And this is part of a massive refurb throughout the Department of Energy to build these weapons out. Just like our delivery systems need to be modernized, that part of our deterrent force needs to be modernized. And the mere fact that that exists is a huge showcase to the world that the United States has the will to continue this kind of work. If we get to the point where we can't build new weapon systems, if we can't build new warheads, if we can't keep these things safe, secure, and reliable, eventually that will cause a question in someone's mind, and we don't ever want questions about this deterrent force. I absolutely, 100% from the bottom of my soul, believe that our force is credible and safe, secure, and effective today. We need to make sure that that's true into the future.
Yeah, in order for us to continue to lead this enterprise, we need to have the weapon systems that allow us to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Earlier this summer, we saw a very surprising attack in June where Ukraine launched the spiderweb attack in the middle of Russia, and they struck some of their strategic assets, damaging and destroying a portion of the strategic bomber fleet. How do we need to think about defending our own nuclear forces when we see these emerging threats around the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's no doubt that Operation Spiderweb got the attention of the entire world, and the United States Air Force is no exception to that. We absolutely are paying attention to that. I think that the disruptive technology of drone technology and things that we're seeing on the battlefield in Ukraine will have big implications, not just for our bomber force or our nuclear force, but really any critical infrastructure throughout, right? So it's important to know that they didn't just take out bombers, they took out AWACS. There's other things that happened in that attack. Our United States Air Force is working hard at developing the capabilities to counter this disruptive technology. Our nuclear forces, I actually think, are in a little bit better position than some of our other mission spaces. It's important to remember ICBMs are in hardened shelters that are designed to withstand a near hit to a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, from a nuclear weapon.
From a nuclear weapon. Our B-2s are in hangars. Our cruise missiles for our B-52s are in hardened facilities. That doesn't mean I'm taking it lightly. We always have to continue. But we have counter drone capabilities at these bases. Do we need to continue to modernize? Do we need to accelerate? Yeah, absolutely, all that. But I clearly think that's something that's front and center in the Department of Defense right now.
Yeah, for sure. I think as you ran down that list of measures that have already been taken across Global Strike Command, you all, of all the major commands in the Air Force, have taken base security extremely, extremely seriously.
Absolutely.
As we look at some of our other facilities, there's certainly going to have to be a relook as we look at how do we defend some of our tactical air forces across the United States, which may not be as safe as we had once thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's move the conversation over to Sentinel. The Air Force and Northrop Grumman recently reached an agreement concerning the Sentinel launch facilities. And can you tell us more about this agreement and what does it mean for the overall Sentinel program?
Mm-hmm. So I think you're probably referring to what we call the Omnimod work that was recently done this summer. So as some of our viewers here may know, a lot of work on the Sentinel program there were some initial pauses coming out of the Nunn-McCurdy reviews of 2024 as the program office worked on what are some ways to restructure, what are some ways to cut cost and schedule to get back into the left of where we need to be. Primarily, a lot of that work that was paused was on the what we call the command and launch segment, so launch silo work, launch facility work, infrastructure work, because it didn't make sense to continue building out something if we knew we were going to change it or we knew we might change it. That is not the same as saying no work has happened on Sentinel. Some amazing things have happened on Sentinel over the last year. What Omnimod did is it kind of codified some of the work that the program office has been doing so that Northrop, that had been told to halt on some things, can now go back to work on some of those issues. So risk reduction work and the like. I think I take it as a huge indicator of us moving forward on Sentinel, that we aren't where we were in 2024.
Yeah.
And so as you look at across the board on Sentinel, whether it's the missile that's had successful qual test on stage one and stage two in 2025, whether it's in the command and launch and the design work on the launch silos, which we just talked about in Omnimod, whether it's decisions from Air Force Global Strike to move forward on building new silos as a more cost-effective way of getting after it than trying to refurb old silos. All these things are factors as we go forward in a gargantuan program.
Yeah, we forget that we invested so much in this program years ago, and we've never had to refurb a program like this, you know, in the history. And so trying to go back and do that, we're running into some roadblocks.
That's right.
But it's good to hear that we're making progress.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at all of our nuclear force, one of the things that I think is really important to remember is we don't have the luxury of stopping our current work while we build out our new work, right? So this isn't a situation where, you know, you fly your fighter to Davis-Monthan and you get out of it, you sign your name on the side of the plane, then you go train on something else and you come back up a few months later onto status. We have to be on alert just as effective on our last day as we are on the first day of the new system. And so because of that, it's just a different way of looking at these infrastructures. When we built these things out in the 60s, we had to build out something which was gargantuan in and of itself. But now we are doing it at the same time we're keeping the old stuff going. And so it just, right. It's a challenge, and we're up to the challenge. We're working.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. Having run the RPA Enterprise out at Creech, we had 22 aircraft that were airborne basically 24 hours
all
a day, 7 days a week. The CFAC demanded that we provide this air power, and then we had to move buildings over at Creech, where we had to move all the ground control stations from one building to the other. Well, you got to find a way to continue to provide that same air power to the CFAC and not interrupt any of your air operations. And a lot of people don't realize a lot of work goes on behind the scenes to make sure you still meet those national security requirements that are never ending.
And it speaks to the importance of air power and that our senior leadership absolutely relies on what airmen bring to the fight every day.
Yeah, fantastic. Regarding the B-21 program,
okay.
Another key aspect of our nation's modernization is the B-21, and recently Congress passed legislation providing additional funding that accelerates the B-21 acquisition. What are the implications for the future of this air leg of our nuclear deterrent?
Well, so the B-21 is absolutely foundational to the Triad, absolutely foundational to nuclear deterrent, actually also absolutely foundation to our conventional capabilities and fights, right? It's a dual-capable asset. I think the work you've seen from the Congress to get us those additional funding tells me a couple things that are very important. One is it's going to go a long ways to be able to help us facilitize and get to the point where we can build this thing at scale. Right. So up until now, we've done the initial R&D work, we've started flight test, I think we publicly stated recently that we believe the second aircraft will take to the skies soon. So all these things are great indicators of success at a program that's on time, on budget, and producing. But eventually you have to get to the point where we scale this thing. And so that that's very important. I think the other piece to it, though, is it's a absolute show of confidence by the Congress that we're on the right track on this program. We've done a lot of work to hold changes to the minimum, to allow the program office and the contractor to get after it, and it's paying dividends.
Yeah, it's such an important piece to continued modernization. People don't realize the B-2, it looks new because it's, you know, super stealthy, it's black, you see it flying around, you're like, wow, it looks like it's out of the movies. But the technology on the B-2 compared to what you're going to find on the B-21 is pretty old technology.
Yeah. So absolutely. So the B-21, you know, unfortunately in an unclassified 7, there's not going to be a lot we talk about it, but it is an amazing capability for our country. Can't wait to get it in the flight line.
Yeah, it's going to provide options to our decision makers that we can't provide right now, and that's just tremendous.
Absolutely. And thanks to the work the Congress has done, we're going to be able to scale that in the future as we come up with what's the final number.
Yeah, that's great. Moving the conversation to nuclear command and control.
Okay.
That's one aspect that doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's absolutely critical to our modernization, to the nuclear enterprise, and the Air Force is providing that behind the scenes. So what's so important about the NC3 modernization? Can you give us some context? Can you give us a peek behind the curtain for folks that aren't tracking this, you know, every day?
Sure. So start off with some basic principles. In the United States system, the President of the United States is the sole authority for nuclear weapons use. And so because of that, it's absolutely critical that we have communication and C2 capability from the President of the United States to the submarine, to the bomber, to the missile field in very quick amount of time, because in some cases that's very important. If you were able to sever the communication between the President of the United States and the field, then you don't have a deterrent force. And so what we call kind of lovingly the fourth leg of the triad is absolutely critical to our capability. And going back to our capability, our will, and being seen to have both, if you have an ability to sever something, then you don't have that capability. Even if you have the will, you wouldn't have the capability. And so NC3 is absolutely critical. NC3 is actually a system of systems. So we're talking multiple hundreds of systems that go together. Many are dual use. You know, this radio may be on a conventional asset as well as a nuclear asset, right? This system, you know, maybe you're talking a NAOC or a SAOC, you know, our command and control platform is a node that has nodes within it that are also nodes. And so it gets very complex very quickly. And based on that, there are various levels of these systems that are in different stages of modernization. So some we just modernized, some we're way behind on modernizing and we need to get after it, and some are in the process. And so it's a constant effort on your Air Force's part. We hold not quite 3/4 of the NC3 systems for the entire United States in our United States Air Force. And so it's something we take very seriously and get after it.
Well, I hope you have some very talented systems engineers.
Absolutely.
Because that is quite a responsibility.
Program office up at Hanscom Air Force Base, and very proud of what they do. Yeah. It's the first trip I took in this job was to get there and develop that relationship.
Wow, that's tremendous. Talking about multiple threat vectors, there are those who argue that the funds for nuclear modernization could be better spent elsewhere. Other nations, or our nation, faces multiple threats. So why should nuclear modernization be such a high priority when we're facing so many other threats to our national security?
Okay. So I really, to the discussion of, you know, why are we spending this kind of money on this while there's other issues out there? I think there's really two ways I look at that question, because I get it from time to time. The first one is, why do we have a triad? Maybe we shouldn't have a triad. Maybe we should have a dyad, a monad, or maybe we should just unilaterally disarm. There's that kind of camp. Yeah. And then there's the kind of camp that says, I acknowledge we need to have a triad, but this widget is too much, or maybe we should hold off for a couple more years on that widget or the like, right? So I'll take both of those in turn, if you don't mind. So the first simple answer on the triad is it's a national discussion. It's not an Air Force discussion, right? So The President of the United States has directed that there will be a triad. He did that based on almost universal agreement among his advisors. By the way, every administration since Truman has come to that conclusion, and there has been numerous studies to discuss if what makes sense. And there's a reason for that. The reason is the existential threat of these weapons to us and the value of the triad. Each part of that triad has unique contributions that aid to deterrence. And assurance, right? So there is the discussion of how much is enough to deter only a strike against the United States. But of course, foundational to our strategy is we also provide extended deterrence to 30 plus allies as well. And all that has to go into the calculus. And so I think that is, you can kind of, we'll set aside that for now, right? We're executing it because it's an existential threat and because we've been at a national level, a decision has been made to do that. Now, to the next side, there's many people out there that say, okay, you know, Andy, I get it. You're beating me up over the head with a triad, but it's still expensive, and how do we get after, you know, maybe we should delay this or do that. I think I always remind people of first principles. You have to have capability. You have to have will, and you have to be seen to have both. The bombers we have were built in 1960 and in the early 90s. That's our force. The ICBMs we have were, you know, built in 1970 and put into an infrastructure that was built in the early 1960s. The command and control aircraft we have was built in the early 70s. And so over time, if you want to have capability and you want to be seen to have capability and will, you've got to modernize these systems. It's equipment, so eventually equipment will age out. And so then the question becomes, well, can we just delay some of this until later? And I think there's pretty well-documented work that shows that we have already waited too long in some cases and we're behind the curve. Right. That is not to say that we are not safe, secure, and reliable today. I'm absolutely confident that if the president gave the order to generate and then beyond, that would be successful. But we're not building this for today. We're building it out for decades in the future to assure our allies and to assure the United States, the people of the United States, that we've got it.
Right. So, how does this conversation play into the sizing of the B-21 fleet as we look at how many B-21s are going to be enough?
Well, I'll tell you, Houston, I've publicly testified to Congress twice that I believe our nuclear deterrent force and the program of record we have for it is absolutely necessary but maybe insufficient for the future based on the fact that this was designed in between the Cold War and the world we live in today.
Gotcha.
By the way, OSD has also testified to that. STRATCOM has also testified to that, et cetera. The Congressional Commission that Congress had look into this also came up with that conclusion. The question really is then is, okay, so if it may be insufficient, what do we need to do to make it sufficient in the future? That's the work that still has to be done. And that's more than just B-21. That's across the breadth and width of our capabilities. B-21 numbers will absolutely be reliant on the work STRATCOM is doing on what is sufficient. But it's important to remember this is also the backbone of our conventional force. And so we aren't building out B-21 numbers only for our triad. We're also building it out for our long-range strike capability. And so all that will go into it. Our Air Force's view is that we need at least 100 B-21s. There have been many studies that talk about a greater number than that. There also is an ends, ways, and means discussion that everyone in the building is constantly going through as we balance out other mission priorities. And so we'll continue to have those discussions. The good news is the B-21 is producing. It's results-oriented in-flight test, basically on time, basically on budget, and the decisions on how to go forward and what the eventual number is are decisions we're working towards, not the stuff that we've already missed opportunity.
Right. Yeah, I think the future B-21 fleet will be tremendous when you look at what happened with Midnight Hammer. Overwhelmingly successful single strike. But we could not have maintained a campaign given the size of our current fleet.
Our bomber force right now is optimized for raids and small scale, a few nights at a time. There's no guarantee that'll be the case in the future.
Right. B-21 would give us more options for our national security decision
Absolutely.
Makers. So
Absolutely.
Fantastic. There's been a lot of talk about Golden Dome, how this is going to be the nation's next generation air and missile defense shield. Some are concerned about this might destabilize as we look at ICBM defense. Are you worried about Golden Dome's effect on strategic balance as we look at our adversaries and how they might interpret this?
No, I'm actually not concerned about that at all. So if deterrence relies on capability, will, and being seen to have both, if you have something that degrades the capability of the adversary nation to hurt us, that adds to deterrence because they will wake up and they will say, should today the day? No, we are not likely to achieve our objectives, and it's going to cause us a lot more harm than good. And so today is not the day. And that's what success looks like for deterrence. And you do that every day forever. And so the Golden Dome is hugely important for that. The most foundational duty we have as military personnel is to protect the United States of America and our allies, and Golden Dome is absolutely foundational to that. Now, beyond that, to the issue of, well, what will our adversaries react to this, I think it's very important to understand our adversaries are not building out like gangbusters because of Golden Dome. We're building Golden Dome because our adversaries are building out like gangbusters, right? So the Golden Dome project is getting started in the year 2025. The adversary and other countries that are building out started their build out many, many years before that. So this is not an issue of because the United States did something, we're going to build out. We are reacting to that in, as any nation would, to protect our interests. And so I don't see that. I see them as complementary, not destabilizing.
Yeah, fantastic. As we look at space, recently the Mitchell Institute conducted a war game. We made our participants operate in a degraded space environment. How is the Air Force planning to execute its nuclear deterrence mission in the event of a degraded space environment? We talked about NC3 earlier, lots of different communication systems. Certainly that's going to play, it's going to have a factor if space is degraded.
Well, I think our entire national security structure is very reliant on space. It's a key reason that the president helped found the Space Force in his first administration. It's the recreation of Space Command, all those realities about the importance of space to our department. Now, having said that, we intentionally design our nuclear force so that we are not reliant on any one capability in order to have deterrence, in order to have that capability and will and be seen to have both. And so our systems are designed to not be wholly reliant on space. Do we want to assure space? Absolutely. I'll just rely on my teammates in the Space Force and Space Command to kind of talk details of that. But our nuclear deterrent is absolutely built around the ability to operate in any environment.
Yeah, fantastic. Last month, we had reports that stated the U.S. is the report stated that the U.S. is redeploying nuclear weapons to RAF Lakenheath over in the United Kingdom. What's the significance of this for our nuclear posture? How about for NATO itself?
Well, I'm not going to confirm or deny the presence of any of our weapons in any specific country. Now, having said that, NATO is a nuclear alliance. They're proud of that. They have stated that over and over. The United States is a huge part of that nuclear deterrence. We provide that extended deterrence in the form of these weapons at certain locations around Europe. And then we train with our allies to have a common understanding of how to utilize those weapons if, God forbid, they were executed.
Right.
That is absolutely foundational to NATO, and it's absolutely foundational to deterring a nuclear-armed adversary in Europe. And so I think the importance of it is both to our ally extended deterrence piece, but also to show our resolve and our willingness to have that capability. I think it's very important to remember as we talk about this modernization challenge that you and I have been talking about, the first thing we did was our NATO nuclear deterrent force. And so whereas years ago you would have older fighters with Cold War era weapons, we now have F-35, fifth gen sensor fused aircraft, many of our allies purchasing the same aircraft, common training, common TTPs, with our modernized B-6112 weapon that has been fully deployed throughout the continent. And so I think it goes a long ways towards assurance, and it goes a long ways towards deterrence.
Yeah. Having grown up in the tactical air forces myself, It wasn't until I've been in the Air Force 26 years, and then I'm a general officer stationed in a NATO billet, and now I'm engaging with our NATO partners on a daily basis. And that's when I really started to understand how important that nuclear foundation was to the alliance. You know, here back in America, you just don't hear people talk about it, but it is absolutely foundational to the alliance itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And the power of the NATO is the training and being shoulder to shoulder with our NATO partners. When I flew fighters in Europe as a captain, you know, you would fly from this country through another country to get to a range. There'd be other countries that were coming in with similar techniques and procedures, and we all knew what each other were going to do, and we could all communicate with each other. That is not something that is assured throughout alliances in history. That is something that NATO has worked hard to get to, and it's absolutely foundational to peace and prosperity.
Yeah, it takes a lot of investment. Like you said, the training,
absolutely,
the resources. We have to continue to work at that, or there's going to be a divergence. So,
absolutely.
Fantastic. As we look at adversary modernization, in fall 2024, we saw the PLA Rocket Force test a new ICBM for the first time since the 1980s. Russia used a new conventional intermediate-range ballistic missile against Ukraine. In your opinion, do you think the U.S. is keeping pace with Russian and Chinese investment in their nuclear capabilities?
Mm-hmm. So I'll take a couple of these one at a time. So the Russian nuclear deterrent force has been almost completely modernized. So they've been at this for a long time. And if you ask me, has that been degraded because of Ukraine? Largely not. The monies that they put to their nuclear deterrent still go there, and that has priority over their Ukrainian issues. So that's Russia. On China, China made a decision years ago to shift from a minimal deterrent force to building out in a strategic breakout that we see today. I've been in this job not quite 2 years. In the 2 years that I've been in this job, the Chinese have added the equivalent, essentially, of almost the UK's entire nuclear deterrent. They're building fast,
wow,
and they're going fast. And so, and they were going to continue to do that. Right, that's not something that they've kind of stopped now. They're still going. You know, North Korea, it maybe not in the news as much lately, but they have not stopped. I'll just leave it at that.
Wow.
So they're going, and they're going fast. Is that a concern? Absolutely, it's a concern. But it's also important to remember the United States has capabilities too, and we have progress too. So a couple things I'll just kind of throw out. So I already talked about our NATO nuclear deterrent has been modernized. Our B-61-13, which is a variant of that modernization that will go on our bombers, is about a year early right now. Mm-hmm. Our F-35 actually was nuclear certified slightly early, several months early.
Mm-hmm.
Our LRSO missile, which will go on our bomber force, has had 4 successful flight tests in 2025 alone.
Wow.
And is basically on time, basically on budget, doing very well. B-21, we've already talked about, doing very well. And so there's a lot of things that are on track and
progressing.
Yeah, we certainly
have programs,
right?
Maybe not in the news every day.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's human nature for guys like me to focus on where the attention needs to be because we've got work we got to do. And we're absolutely going to do that. We need to get that stuff back to the left, and we need to have a sense of urgency. But I also want the American people to understand that there is a lot of progress happening.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for that update.
Yeah, absolutely.
Finally, let's talk about New START. The last remaining arms control treaty between the U.S. and Russia is set to expire in February 2026.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean for U.S. deterrence and global arms control if a new treaty is not signed after the New START expires? And maybe to start off with some of our viewers' understanding, explain what START is all about and then maybe go into what happens if it
so
expires.
So the New START treaty signed several years ago when relations were much different than they are today, and it caps the number of deployed nuclear forces. So there's numbers that have caused the United States to limit the number of warheads that are on our ICBMs to a single each. They could go up to 3, but we have 1 because of the treaty. It has capped the number of warheads that go on our submarines, and so the Navy has capped some of their launch tubes to comply with the treaty. And then the treaty also, interestingly, defines a bomber as 1 counter, even though a bomber might have more than 1 weapon on it, but that was all negotiated in the treaty. And so that keeps us at rough parity with the Russians. Now, that treaty does not cover all types of nuclear weapons. There are tactical nuclear weapons that do not fall within the criteria of the treaty, but largely it's kept those numbers tight. It is only a treaty between the Russians and the United States. The Chinese are not signatories to that treaty.
Right.
And so the treaty has been allowed to, it had different increments, and it is expiring on its last increment in February of 26.
Right.
To the issue of what happens to arms control. So I think there's a couple things from an Air Force service perspective, and I'll leave, you know, to the State Department, national, you know, foreign policy, and to the President for negotiations. But from the Air Force perspective, after the treaty expires, the Russians are no longer obligated to keep their numbers to where the New START has them, right? So based on that, the President may or may not elect to keep our numbers where they are, or he may change those numbers. We train and are prepared to add to those numbers if so ordered.
Gotcha.
If not, then we won't. I mean, it's that simple, right? Now, to the issue of arms control, the next kind of thing I often hear when I hear people talk about this last treaty is going away is kind of, oh my gosh, arms control is dead. There's no future. The Chinese don't want to talk to us. The Russians are serial violators of the treaty, and all that. Putting aside the kind of my personal views of all that, I would just say it's important for us to remember that some of the biggest arms control treaties in history were done at some of the hottest times of the Cold War, right? So I don't think it's true to say that because we have the international situation we have today, there's no hope for arms control. Right? The President, at his core, is a negotiator, and he is interested in making the world safer, and I'm sure he would love to do a deal. But that deal has to have certain criteria. I think to have successful arms control, if you look at history of treaties that have gone well and ones that haven't, you really have three parts to it. First of all, you have to have a shared sense of what strategic stability looks like at the end game. So if there's a country that just cannot live with the end game of the status quo or reducing the status quo, then you're not going to have a treaty. They're not going to sign on to it, right? So we have to convince the Chinese that it's in their interest to change the status, the situation as they see,
yeah,
or we're not going to have an agreement, right? Second thing is you need to have some level of transparency. So you can't really talk about limiting numbers if you don't know how much they have and what they'll go to. I mean, it's not fruitful to do that.
Yeah.
And then I think the third thing is you have to have verifiability, right? So once you don't have to be best friends, but you have to agree on what stability looks like. You have to basically know what they have, and then you have to verify that they actually got to the numbers you agreed to. And if you can't do those things, you're not going to get arms control. But if you can, notice I didn't say you have to be on the Christmas card list. That doesn't have to be one of the criteria to get arms control. And so, you know, we'll see what the future holds of that. But from an Air Force point of view, we're prepared to do what the President wants us to do.
Yeah, thanks for walking through that criteria.
Sure.
Because for those of us who aren't in that conversation every day, we just don't think through those variables.
Sure.
So that's really important. Well, fantastic. Well, sir, thanks so much for the opportunity to share all those thoughts.
Enjoyed
and those
it.
Ideas. We're going to open it up to questions from the audience now.
Okay.
And you all know the drill. Josh will call on you, and when he does, please unmute your mics and state your name and affiliation before asking your question. You can also submit your questions using the Q&A function. So, Josh, who do we have first?
Thanks, Houston. Our first question is from Joseph Trevithick from the War Zone. He says, we've heard that the goal is for the second B-21 to make its first flight soon. Is that a milestone expected to come before the end of the year or sooner? Thanks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the question. So this is an event-based process based on the test team, the contractor, the program office. I believe it will happen before the end of the year, but we're not going to ever give them an artificial date that they have to make if it doesn't bring the test program along to where they need to be. And so, you know, we're gonna proceed as we can efficiently, effectively, and with a sense of urgency. But we're also going to be event based, and that's really been the secret sauce to the B-21 right now is no undue pressures. Let them do what they're doing, and they'll get us the world's best aircraft here very soon.
Who's next, Josh?
Our next question is from Audrey Decker of Defense One. Audrey, please unmute your mic. Over to you.
Hi, thank you so much for doing this. Two Sentinel questions, if I may. On the Sentinel's first flight test, a recent GAO report estimated that flight test would be delayed to about 2028. So I was just wondering if you have an update on when the first flight test might happen. And then also earlier this year, the service said that they're going to need to dig new silos instead of reusing the Minuteman ones. So, you know, now that the service might have to build possibly hundreds of new silos, like how long are you expecting to have to keep Minuteman running? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So for specifics on when the first flight of the missile will be, I think we're going to start testing well prior to that, but I will defer to the program office on specifics. I think that we are doing a good job in our restructure of when and what are we trying to get out of each specific test. So let me give you an example of that. In the original plan, we wanted to start testing these missiles from silo launch. That really hasn't ever happened in other missile programs in the past. They've launched from a pad. They've learned the lessons they need to do that test. They move forward. They go to the next step. And so the program, as part of our restructure, is taking all that into account to get back to the left on time and schedule and cost. So I don't think it's going to be that long. I think that was kind of what it would be if nothing changed, which stuff is changing. To the second question of digging new silos and what is that going to be for time, the decision was made earlier this summer that it was going to be more cost-effective and quicker to just go build new in greenfields than it would be to build, to refurb an existing silo. There's a couple reasons for that. The first thing is you can only do so many at one time if you're using the same missiles that have to be constantly on alert as well, because those missiles have a certain number of missiles have to always be on alert. And so because of that, you spread out the amount of time because you can only do a few at a time. It's very inefficient for the workforce. And, of course, that also adds to cost because that workforce then needs to be paid and housed and fed and the like for more years than they needed to otherwise have. If you just go out to a new site, then you can just rage, get it done more quickly. Now, in most cases, we believe that the launch facilities that exist today have enough space on them that you can do it in areas that the United States already owns. There may be a small number that you may need to expend that out a little bit more. And then in some small cases, we may need to make purchases. And that's the program office is working that every day on where those specifics are. But I believe building all new silos is actually not an extender of time and cost. It's actually saving time and cost, and that's why we're going there. Thank you. Awesome.
Okay, Josh, who's next?
Our next question is from Greg Hadley, Air and Space Forces Magazine. Greg, over to you.
Hi, General. Thanks for doing this. My question was based off something earlier you said about the B-21 and the quantity needed. And you said the work on that, the work to determine the number that will be sufficient is still ongoing. Do you have a sense of how long it will take STRATCOM and the Air Force to finish its analysis and really reach a decision on what it need, how many B-21s it needs?
Greg, so I think you're a little garbled there, but I think what I heard you say is when will we get to the decision on the final number of B-21s? Is that correct?
Yes,
yeah,
sorry.
Okay. No, not your fault at all. So I don't have a date for you on when that will be. I will tell you, though, that the work that the Air Force is doing based on the reconciliation dollars that we've been giving allow us to facilitize to get to scale more quickly over time. That isn't the same as saying we're going to pop out more B-21s next year, but it's saying it's providing all the infrastructure and the effort and the and all that goes into that to be able to make those decisions in the future. Largely, the number of B-21s that can come out in the early years is what it is until we get that work done. So the decision on is it greater than 100? Is it 145? Is it some other number? That's not really going to be affected if we made that decision today. It really doesn't affect for several more years. And so I, like you, am eager to find out what that number is But the reality is that's going to be something that's worked for a long time.
Okay, Josh, who's next?
Our next question is from Brian Everstein of Aviation Week. Brian, over to you.
Hi, thank you so much for doing this. Can you provide any update on the B-52J radar modernization effort? Earlier this year, Ms. Costello told lawmakers that there is an affordability review and also looking at the minimum viable product as part of the minimum security process. Is there any update there?
Right. So earlier in the year, the B-52 radar had a significant non-McCurdy, and there's details of what criteria get you to a critical versus a significant versus not. It's all in the law. And so we were slightly above the significant level. Part of what we did is that to control cost is to work at what are the min things that we need on this radar. As you may recall, we're buying a radar that is largely a F-18 Hornet radar with some small modifications. We did that intentionally because that is what was on the market at the time. It would actually cost us more if we asked to design a new radar. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that we need everything on that radar that the Hornet has on it, right? We have a certain number of min things that we need to do to be able to do our B-52 mission. And so part of the cost savings was looking at what are those things to make sure that we're prioritizing precious dollars on things that we need and not that are good ideas or that we want or the like. That does give us opportunities for growth in the future if it comes to that. To the actual radar itself, I believe that we are very close to getting that first radar to Edwards Air Force Base to begin flight test. I don't have a specific date for you today, but I believe that is turning a corner, and I'm very eager, as a former B-52 pilot, very eager to see that get underway. Thank you.
Fantastic. Josh, who's next?
We have a question from General Robert Elder, commander of the 8th Air Force. General, over to you.
Hey, General Jubera, great to see you. Thanks for taking time with us today. This may be a little more detailed than some of the audience would like to hear, but you talked a little bit about the conventional parts of the B-21, but overall, could you talk about how the non-nuclear strategic forces play in the overall strategic capabilities of the...
Bob, thanks. I think the question you asked was, what do the non-nuclear aspects of our bomber force do for our national security and for our strategic deterrence? Is that the question? Okay, I'm going to go with that. Okay, yeah. So as you know, our bomber force are dual capable. Our bomber force has a critical nuclear mission. They're not currently activated on alert, but they could be at any time that the president gives that order, and we train to returning to alert routinely. When they're not doing that nuclear mission, they're not trained in that nuclear mission, they have a very important conventional mission. That has been seen recently in Midnight Hammer, as Houston and I talked about earlier today. It's also seen in training and partnering missions around the world in our Bomber Task Force missions. Air Force Global Strike Command routinely works with theater combatant commands and allies and partners to execute those missions all around the world at all times. And as recently as when I was in command of the 8th Air Force a couple years ago, we had worked with about 22% of the world's air forces in the time that I was there. And it's only gone up from that since General Armagost has taken command. And so they are a very highly in-demand asset. There is an insatiable appetite for our bomber force. And so there's always a balance of how much can we give to the goodness of going forward versus how much do we need to retain to train versus how much do we need to return to keep logistically strong and ready. And that's something that Air Force Global Strike Command does every day.
Josh, who's got the next question?
Our next question is from Davis Winky, USA Today. Davis, please unmute your mic.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for doing this. My question is related to a review that was recently announced and ordered by the Deputy Secretary of Energy of the National Nuclear Security Administration's plutonium pit production efforts. Those pits are aimed to be in the 87-1 and the 93-0 warheads, which are intended for the Sentinel system. Sir, do you have any growing concerns about the ability of your partners over at the NNSA to have the warheads ready on time for the Sentinel to be used to the fullest extent possible once it's operational and in those silos?
Okay, yeah, thanks for the question. So, slight clarification, the W-93 warhead is a Navy warhead that will go into the SLBM fleet. The WD-7-1 is an Air Force warhead that will go into Sentinel. And so we are required to have two different types of warheads to avoid any kind of technological failure, you know, so that we don't put all our eggs in one basket. One of those warheads will be W-87-0 and one will be W-87-1. To the question of plutonium pits and the ability of the NNSA to deliver on time, I do not currently have any concerns with their ability to do that. There is a gargantuan effort going on in the Department of Energy to get that capability going. We have very close interactions with the NNSA, both in my hat as the DCS for Strategic Deterrence and also through the Nuclear Weapons Council, of which I'm the Air Force's representative. So we constantly talk about schedules there. I was at Savannah River site just a couple of weeks ago. I was also at Los Alamos Lab earlier in the summer to get in-depth discussions on how they're doing on plutonium pits. And I feel like currently we are on path, and they are not a critical path to get our capability. That is just like our delivery systems that we do in the DoD. That is something we track all the time, and it's a snapshot in time, but right now we're doing, it is not critical path.
Awesome. Josh, who's next?
Great. We have a question written in the chat from Heather Penny of the Mitchell Institute. She asked, General, could you comment on the tension between the demand for a conventional bomber capacity and the need for to maintain a nuclear deterrence holdback in the event of a peer conflict?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Heather, I think this is one of the big questions that bomber air crews are always working on and that Air Force Global Strike Command is always working on. So we have to be able to provide forces to STRATCOM, and then that STRATCOM commander needs to be confident in the ability of regaining the triad, but also is going to be supporting other theater combatant commands depending on the issue. I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that in an Asia-Pacific theater, long-range strike is going to be very important. Right, I think that's pretty obvious just based on geography. So the ability of our fourth generation bombers, the B-1, the B-52, to be able to get where they need to be and be cruise missile shooters, the ability of our stealth bombers today, B-2 and eventually B-21, to be able to penetrate and get to the targets they need to, that's going to be absolutely foundational to a Pacific fight. We've also seen, you know, just this summer that it's foundational to CENTCOM. And I could include that in UCOM as well. So it's always going to be a factor. The President, the Secretary of Defense, the National Command Authorities will always have to balance that as they figure out how many we can give, because we don't have a force where we have an overage of capability right now. We have a force that is smaller than it's been in decades. We're working to alleviate that. Our bomber vector that we have today, that will have a force of at least 100 B-21s and 75 B-52s, is a larger number of tails than we have today. The question really becomes, then what is the right number? And as I said earlier, that's work that we're still doing.
Awesome. All right, Josh, I think we've got time for one more. Who do we got?
We got a written-in question from Michael Morrow from Breaking Defense. He asks, the Air Force earlier this year issued sources sought notice to industry for potential radar alternatives for the B-52 RMP effort. Has the Air Force decided against selecting a different radar?
So I don't believe we're going to select a different radar. I think we're continuing with the radar we have, and I believe it's going to be flying to Edwards in the short term. So looking forward to that.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of this Aerospace Nation. I'd like to thank General Jabara for taking the time to speak with us today, and from all of us at Mitchell Institute, have a great Air and Space Power kind of day. Thanks very much.